Everyone, please take your seats. We have quorum. Okay, good afternoon. Let's get the meeting started. First item is approval of the agenda. We have, looks like someone's gonna amend the agenda.
Hi, I'd like to add an addition. Item 5B1, the proposal for a BA MA program in biology, dated July 17th, 2014. If anyone doesn't have that handout, it's at the front of the room.
Okay, now I ask for approval of the agenda. All in favor? I'm sorry. First, we have to approve the amendment to the agenda. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries. Now let's go back to the item number one, approval of the agenda. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the agenda is set as amended. Item number two, approval of the Academic Senate meetings of September 11th, 2014. Any changes or corrections? Any objections to the approval? Okay, all in favor? Opposed? Motion carries. Item number three, announcements, administrative reports, and memorials.
Megan Healy, Drama Theater Dance. I wanted to announce that the fall production, which is Teresa Rebeck's Our House, will open next weekend in the M11 Theater, which is in Rathaus Hall, and tickets are available through the Kupferberg Center box office. It's a very interesting contemporary play that explores the relationship between violence and social media.
Other announcements.
Hi there, Raj Maheshwari, President of Student Association. So I just wanted to give a big thanks to the Student Association members, the Queens College Indian Club, and the Queens College Sick Club for helping us out yesterday. And as of 12 o'clock today, we've raised $1,000 towards breast cancer awareness, as it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So a big thanks and a round of applause to the Student Association members. Thank you.
Danielle Yehuzadeh, Student Senate Chair, President of Persian Club. Each year we hold the Persian Formal, which will take place November 20th, 8 p.m., Student Union, 4th floor.
No other announcements. Let's move to the item B first, memorials. Number one, Professor Alexandrov.
Alden Ludman, College at Large, member of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences. And at the last meeting, I was sadly reporting the death of Robert Finks, another one of our retired professors. And today it's Eugene Alexandrov. If I may read, please. Associate Professor Emeritus Eugene Alexandrov passed away on September 16th in New Haven, Connecticut, 1 week after his 98th birthday. Eugene was an economic geologist and shared that knowledge with Queens College students for more than 30 years. Our alumni remember fondly now legendary field trips to North America and Europe to visit world-famous ore mineral deposits, especially his famous shashlik, cooked over many campfires. The enthusiasm with which he collected ore samples was evidenced by the large dents that appeared mysteriously on the tops of departmental vans when the trips returned to campus. When he retired, Eugene left the college a world-class, professionally curated ore mineral collection housed today at the American Museum of Natural History. Eugene received his PhD from Columbia University at the age of 49 and wrote several papers on the origin of mineral deposits. His authoritative book on the mineral and energy resources of the USSR and translations of important Russian articles on metallogeny made an important body of knowledge available to U.S. scientists for the first time. But his interests extended far beyond his scientific works, including a well-received book The Millennium of Christianity in Russia, 988 to 1988. He was one of the founders and first president of the Congress of Russian Americans and was inducted to the Russian American Hall of Fame in 2004. Eugene is survived by his son Vladimir, Queens College geology class of 1968, and Benzinger professor of Slavic languages and literature at Yale University, his daughter-in-law Sybil, and grandchildren Nicholas and Sophia. Thank you.
I ask the Senate to rise for a moment of silence. Thank you. Next memorial is for Professor Bittman.
Robert Engel, Interim Dean, Math and Natural Sciences. It's my sad duty to bring to you news of the passing of a very good friend and colleague of more than 46 years. On the first of this month, distinguished Professor Robert Bittman of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry passed away after an extended battle with pancreatic cancer. Bob was a native of Queens, a graduate of Forest Hills High School in 1958 at the age of 16. He came to Queens College where he earned his BS in chemistry in 1962, summa cum laude. From here, he went on to graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley, where he was mentored by another Queens native, Andrew Streitwiser, who was awarded the PhD in chemistry in 1965. Following this, he spent a year as a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of Nobel laureate Manfred Eigen at the Max Planck Institute for Physical Chemistry in Göttingen. He then returned home to Queens College, where he took up the position of assistant professor of chemistry in the fall of 1966. It was 2 years later that I got to know Bob, arriving as a new assistant professor in chemistry, and Bob showed me the ropes. Dealing with Queens College, living in the area, the subways, finding a good deli, and the Graduate Center. Bob rapidly proceeded through the academic ranks, ultimately becoming a distinguished professor of chemistry in 1988, a position he held throughout the remainder of his career here. This career spent entirely as a member of the faculty of Queens College, Bob published more than 344 papers in refereed journals. The number is not yet complete because there are a number still pending, and manuscripts are still being written by his students. In addition, as secretary of the editorial board of Organic Reactions, a major review publication of the American Chemical Society, he was responsible for the publication of 67 volumes of that issue, along with four other major journals for which he served as editor. Further, he had 104 major presentations at scientific conferences around the world, and numerous patents, had the most impressive distinction of having had continuous funding from NIH from his first year at Queens College to his last. Yet further, he received the prestigious Avanti Award for his work with lipids from the American Chemical Society. While reciting his awards and achievements, the non-numberable items of his career are even more notable. Most highly respected researcher, particularly in the field of lipid chemistry and biochemistry, people around the world sought his collaboration, owing not only to his great talent, but also his personal requirement of excellence in all that he did, and further with his tremendous writing talent. It is notable that he made his entire academic career at Queens College, although there were numerous offers to move to much more financially rewarding positions all over. He had a dedication to New York public education, particularly to Queens College and the maintenance of excellence here. He was quite proud of his public education, from which he received his basic education and then got his start on his illustrious career. He was always concerned about the quality of education here. He was adamant in his attribution of his success to the education provided to him by Queens College. Bob truly felt that Queens College was the source for any success he may have found in his career. In recent years, Bob was mainly teaching advanced organic and biochemistry courses. And quite often he would come to me saying, student X is having difficulty in my course. He seems to know no carbohydrate chemistry. Are you still teaching that in Chem 252? I would reassure him that yes, we were still teaching carbohydrate chemistry, including the modern aspects of stereospecific synthesis so important for pharmaceutical work. And I'd check on it. Invariably, when I came back to report to him, I would say, student X is a transfer student. He didn't do his basic work here. And signature reply of Bob was, well, that explains it. I have a lot more work to do with him. In my visits to talk with him during his last weeks, it was both significant that his concerns weren't about his health, but for the maintenance of Queens College as an excellent institution, and most importantly, the welfare of his students. Take care of them for me. Help them finish their work and go on to successful careers of their own. This was his concern. Rest assured that we will do.
Please stand for a moment of silence. Thank you very much. I have the privilege of presenting today's guest speaker, Professor Jonathan Buxbaum, who has taught in the Media Studies Department, formerly the Communication and Arts Department, since 1977. He began here as an instructor before receiving his PhD at NYU in 1983. His scholarly work is concentrated on political filmmaking and more recently on the politics of film industry. He has written two books and a third book is forthcoming next year in 2015. He is now the acting chair of the Media Studies Department, and since 2000, he has been the Professional Staff Congress chapter chair here at Queens College, and he also serves on the PSC CUNY Executive Council. Professor Buxbaum.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to start off by thanking my colleague, Professor Sanudo, for inviting me to speak today at the Senate. I confess that I haven't been here often in the past, occasionally, but I'm delighted to be here, particularly because I'd like to say a few words, or actually probably read a few words, about what I think would be a very helpful and fruitful attempt to work together as a chapter chair and that leading the chapter here to work more closely with the Senate than we have in the past, because I think we have many shared interests. And that's what I'm going to direct my remarks to now. We often say in the union that teacher worker conditions are student learning conditions. That is, it can be difficult to keep the realm separate, and I think maybe I'm trying to say today that we should not think of them as separate. And I'd like to start off considering two historical changes in higher education. And I think that these are two critical transformations that have affected higher education throughout the country over the past, let's say, 40 years. Then I'll make a couple of comments about some issues that are specific to Queens and CUNY. First, in terms of these national trends, there's been a massive decline in full-time faculty and an even greater explosion of part-time faculty, also known as adjuncts, and perhaps more accurately called contingent faculty, for they have no job security from one semester to the next. Just to give you a brief background, in the late 1970s, when I first started teaching at Queens, there were almost 12,000 full-time faculty. Now there are about, let's say, 8,000, just to keep the round figures. So we've dropped from 12,000 full-time to 8,000 full-time. Yet the student population has increased. So therefore, there are the same number of courses, or let's say arguably more courses needed. So who teaches all those courses formerly taught by full-time faculty? Part-time faculty, contingent faculty. There are now 13,000 of them at CUNY. That's the way they replaced full-time faculty, by hiring part-time faculty that do not have tenure-track positions. Is that a union issue or a Senate issue? On the one hand, accreditation of the college requires an adequate percentage of classes taught by full-time faculty. On the other hand, adjuncts have no job security. That often forces adjunct, and students often don't know if a teacher is part-time or not. It forces the adjunct faculty to scurry about from one school to another to make ends meet. They have less time to meet with students and are not paid to prepare for classes. They're paid by the hour to be in the classroom. They're not paid to prepare for class, as the rest of us who are full-time are. The union succeeded in providing for a paid office hour for many adjuncts to ensure that adjuncts would have paid time to meet with students. In the past, many adjuncts did hold office hours, but they were unpaid. So they were doing that because they were committed to the students and the quality of education here at Queens. Now it's a contractual right. That means that it's part of the contract between CUNY and the union, the PSC CUNY, the Professional Staff Congress. So it's required for many adjuncts. I won't go into the reasons I say many as opposed to all. Not every adjunct has to do it or is paid for it. However, with no form of job security, more than half of the courses taught at Queens do not enjoy the protection of tenure that also protects academic freedom. In other words, adjuncts don't have the same protection to teach what they like, say what they like in class, because they're often fearful of not being rehired in case there's some problem that comes up. Maybe a problem wouldn't come up, but they don't have that protection. Second, in terms of the second long-term trend. Before 1975, when New York City went through what was called a fiscal crisis, and here I may be addressing more the younger people in the audience than the older ones, though, you know, I've been here a long time, and a lot of people have come here as teachers since me. Not everyone may know this, but the university instituted tuition for the first time in 1975. Previously, CUNY was free, if you can imagine that idea. What that means is that the state and city used to provide all the funding for the university. As the state and city withdrew funding, who paid to replace that money? The students. They were the ones called upon to replace that money. Now, if you're concerned about access to higher education and the groundbreaking open admissions at CUNY, which guarantees a CUNY education to all New York City high school graduates, then tuition prevents many students from taking advantage of that policy. So if access is a priority, and by implication, it is a priority according to the charter of the Senate, does tuition then become an issue for the union and the Senate? I would say yes. It's something that we're all concerned about, to guarantee that access. Now, increasing reliance on adjuncts and the constant rise in tuition are two long-term changes, as I said, in higher education. Both affect the quality of education offered at Queens College. And the union and the Senate can, in my view, and should work together to address those trends in order to constantly seek to raise the quality of education. And I was very moved by Dean Engel's comments on Professor Bittman, because clearly his whole career did reflect a commitment to public education, specifically here at Queens College. And I had the good fortune, actually, to meet Professor Bittman because I heard that he was a tennis player. So I thought, well, I'm trying to see who's good here at Queens. So I asked if I could play with him once, and he invited me to come out to where he lived, where we played. And I guess I shouldn't be embarrassed to say that I lost to him. I was a little distraught about it, but he was also an excellent tennis player. To take now more specific examples at CUNY and Queens, is there anyone here who's not affected by CUNY First? No one knows how much CUNY paid for this dysfunctional system. But a rough figure is 500 million? A billion, the provost is indicating. Yes, I said a rough figure, but more recently I've heard $1 billion. I mean, I won't go into details about the fact that it was not beta tested before we took it on here, that they don't have a system for testing it before it got rolled out. I mean, we were actually the guinea pigs here at Queens and Queensborough also. Now, that dysfunction certainly affects working conditions of everyone at the college, but it also affects students. Is that a union matter or a Senate matter? Many of you took part in endless discussions of pathways here. A senator of this body described it publicly, I think, as, and I'm quoting here, an abomination, pathways. Yet he voted in favor of it out of concern for the effect opposition to pathways would have on students. The union and the university faculty senate joined to bring legal action against CUNY for the unilateral imposition of such devastating curricular changes opposed by so many faculty, turning faculty governance into a caricature. I said a moment ago that teacher working conditions are student learning conditions. There are currently abominable conditions in the science building, in labs, in the music building, that faculty are extremely concerned about. The union has been talking to the administration for years about this. Clearly, that is part of our working conditions. But it's also part of student learning conditions. You can't sit in class in 80, 90 degree temperatures and expect to learn. Teachers know that. It's no secret that students know it also. Is that a Senate issue also? It's certainly a union issue. Now, I could go on in the same vein for some time, but I trust my point is clear. These kinds of issues affect all of us at the college, and many are CUNY-wide. Trying to separate so-called governance issues from union issues is like calculating the number of angels on the head of a pin. It's often impossible, and I would say undesirable. As I've been a union officer for some years now, I want to conclude with one point. The current union leadership is committed to social justice. To the extent that the contract does not promote social justice, we're always seeking to expand the reach of the union to social justice. I'm here hoping that the Senate shares that fundamental commitment. Thank you. Yeah, sure. Manny said that there might be some questions, so I'm here hoping there will be some.
Grover, philosophy. Jonathan, you mentioned that the union and the UFS had come together and worked together on the lawsuits connected with Pathways. So why isn't that the right level for PSC CUNY, which after all is a union for the whole of CUNY? Why isn't that the right level for union faculty governance body coordination rather than college by college? I guess that's, you know, it's a structural question really. Why do it here given that we're doing it at the top?
Well, I would say instead of the question being rather than, why not in addition to, complementary with? Part of the problem with CUNY over the last, let's say, decade or more, especially under Chancellor Goldstein, is that there was a very top-down approach toward imposing rules on the colleges so that the colleges complained about not having enough autonomy. Well, the Senate is one body where you can exercise autonomy. And some senates did say to the local presidents, no, we're not going to accept Pathways. We were happy to talk about it. Many of the faculty here were on committees who said, we need to talk about it. Some of those faculty even resigned in protest. Well, it seems to me that the local senates, the college senates, are an appropriate body to raise these concerns first to the president, because the president then can convey those concerns to the chancellor. It's a way of balancing out the unilateral imposition of rules and regulations on the colleges to talk back. There should be a dialogue. It shouldn't be unilateral.
Alan Ludman, College at Large. We have a unique governance system here. I don't know if this is working or not. I'll use my professor voice. We have a unique governance system. We deal with curriculum here. Personnel is dealt with by a different group. And I know you have reported you do sit in on the executive, on the college P&B meetings, and that's where a lot of the personnel issues, many of which you've just described, are dealt with. There's a regular way of doing that. There is this, you may speak. You are given time whenever you need it. I would think that whenever there's a curriculum issue, all you have to do is do what you've done now and ask the executive committee to bring that curriculum issue to us. I think it's our job to listen to you. But again, we can only listen really to the curriculum issues because that's what we have autonomy to address.
Well, that's fair enough, Alan. In fact, there was someone, the president of the union, came to this body to address it on Pathways last year, I think. But if I'm not mistaken, I took a look at the charter of the Senate before I came here, and it talks very specifically about admissions. Hence, the idea of tuition seems to me perfectly appropriate. Well, I ended my remarks by encouraging the Senate to take a more active, what I call a kind of social justice approach toward its own commitment, that is, toward what it feels are its responsibilities. So it can expand, perhaps, its purview beyond what may be in those few words, actually, that are in the charter. And admissions, as I say, is one of them. I mean, you know, it's just, I think, wrong that there should be tuition at a public school, frankly. And the idea that the state governments can do this with impunity is wrong. And therefore, this is an area that I think the Senate could intervene in. I mean, don't get the wrong idea. I don't think that Governor Cuomo is going to wake up tomorrow morning and think that it's a disgrace that there's tuition. I understand that. But I think that working together with the union, who, as Alan said, does speak up on personnel matters, but we speak up on matters way beyond personnel matters. And we try and expand the range of the contract when needed. I'm proposing simply that we work together, and I take Alan's comment as an invitation to do that by coming perhaps more regularly here and explaining how we can do that in a complementary way with dialogue. Okay, well, thank you very much for the chance to talk to you today.
The next item on the agenda is going to be committee reports. Item 5A, Undergraduate Curriculum Committee.
Ken Lord, Chair, Undergraduate Curriculum Committee. I see we've switched to blue. I'd like to move the minutes of the September 11th Undergraduate Curriculum Committee meeting and ask for unanimous consent.
Any objections?
Okay. Kevin Ferguson, Department of English. Did I beat you?
No, you beat me, definitely.
I wanted to talk about page 4 and 5, changes to the women in the women's studies major, and I was excited to see that there was a change in a revision of the women's studies major to include gender, which is a topic that's very important, not only in academics, but also in our society. But I was really disheartened to see how little gender was written into the changes of the major. It doesn't seem that anything about the major was structurally changed to account for gender. And not even, in fact, the WOMST code abbreviation. Maybe WGST is already taken or something, we couldn't use it. I think it's really clear in the distributions. There's 4, and then there's another one. And if you look at the first one, Scientific Theories of Gender, I see that 2 courses were added, a course on the human skeleton and a biology course. And I think having those courses in there actually really undermines the point of gender studies, which is that biological sex is distinct from cultural expressions of gender or identity. And so while I think students should take a course on the human skeleton and learn about biological sex, to call that a theory of gender is sort of misguided or wrongheaded. And when we see women in cultural traditions and women in society as categories, it seems to me that that repeats the same sort of error. If you imagine what I think are the 2 most salient issues of gender in our society today, gay marriage and transgender rights and equality, where would courses on that fit in these categories? Would a course on gay marriage be under women and family, or how would that even work? The top of the next page continues this. The following courses may deal with topics concerning women and women's roles. And I think that excludes, it's not only that it doesn't have a place for gender, but it excludes entire swaths of gendered experience, gay male experience, transgender issues, queer cultures and intersectionality in general. So I guess I'm objecting in a way to the addition of gender, that it's something that seems, in the title I should say of the major, that it seems sort of tacked on. And then on top of that, there's lots of sloppiness. There's lots of mistakes in the courses that are listed here that are going to introduce error and raise confusion. So back to the top, number 3. It says, and I'll confess that I actually don't fully understand why some things are italicized and why some aren't. I understand that underlining means it's being added to the description, but I would like to have seen requirements for the major in women. I would like to have seen and gender underlined to show that we're actually changing the title of the major. And we see right on the top of the page, environmental sciences is given a nice justification or rationale of that. We don't have that given at all here. Women under the core requirements, women's studies 101, 201W, 310, and 320. There's also a women's studies 101W. It seems that should go on that list so that if students take that, they can also get major credit. Bio 22 is listed in the current bulletin both as a reserve class and under biology. Obviously, it can't be either one, and that might just be a mistake with the bulletin. Under the Women and Cultural Traditions category, I see that Sociology 243 and 244 are added, but they're also in the next category, Women in Society. So should those have been stricken? If they're meant to be in 2 places, can a student take that one course and get double credit? What's the difference between a cultural tradition and a society? Why are these categories distinct in the first place? I couldn't find, under Women in Society, History 247, Women in Modern European History in the bulletin. There is, a few lines down, History 308, Women in Modern European History. Urban Studies 114, they call it Sex in the City on the website, but it's in the bulletin Sexual Variance in the City, which is a small distinction. And then on the top of the next page, just two or three more. Political Science 381 doesn't exist, but there's a 381W. It's listed as 3-hour for credit, which raises the question of students needing to take more than 36 hours, and there's also prerequisite kind of issues for that. English 396 is on reserve, which means we haven't taught it in 5 years, and I don't know of any plans to teach it, so that probably shouldn't be on that list. And last, under electives, Complet 229W is women in modern world literature, so it's missing a word there and makes it difficult to find that course. So aside from those kind of like nitpicky details, my main objection is the sort of sense that gender can be thrown into the women's studies program in a sort of token way, and that is sort of detrimental and actually speaks against the point of even the most broadest kind of gender studies issue. Having said that, I know it's an interdisciplinary major. It relies on other departments offering these courses, not changing their requirements. It's a small program. There's not the resources of a huge department. So I get that it's a difficult thing to pull off, but for that reason, I would think that the UCC and the Senate should take extra care in offering feedback, revision, or support to make sure that we don't have, so that the quality of this major matches, for instance, what we see with music or what we see with environmental sciences, which are really well thought out and fully described in detail.
There's nobody here from Women's and Gender Studies, right? Because I have appreciate all of the comments that were made. As far as why courses are put into what section, I don't know. It seems to me it would be a good idea to withdraw this proposal, and you talk directly to the chair of the Women's Studies Department, rather than through me, because you said it very well. If it's going to be modified, it might as well be modified the right way.
Any objection to withdrawing the proposal, item number 3? It's withdrawn. We had another comment.
Stephen Grover, philosophy. Well, there was no justification provided for the changes in the women's studies major, and that was a point that I was also going to make about the new requirement for the majors in music. On page 1, B1A, I guess. So there are scholastic requirements and there are performance activities in the current major. And now it's proposed to add something which is neither a scholastic requirement nor a performance activity, namely recital attendance. Undergraduate music majors required to basically go to 10 concerts each semester. And in discussing this with the Senator for Music, it seemed unclear whether the requirement was for them to go to concerts here at Queen's College, where their attendance could be policed because they would swipe their cue card into Kupferberg or Lefrak, or wherever they were going, or whether it was meant to cover concerts and recitals anywhere, in which case I think it's not our business to police that or demand ticket stubs from students or anything like that. But because no justification is provided, although the Senator for Music is in fact here, I think that we should give this the same treatment as we just gave to the changes in women's studies and withdraw it and let them come back with a justification next month.
Actually, I just wanted to mention that Music had written a justification for this, which was in the minutes from last month's. And so I believe that might just be a clerical error with these minutes because they had done quite a lengthy justification last time. And I won't speak on behalf of Music, except to say that they were questioned about this quite extensively. It's very standard and common in conservatory programs and arts programs to require things like recital attendance or museum attendance at the program in order to ensure that students are participating and viewing each other's work as a form of criticism and understanding of the form. When you perform in a concert or a theatrical production, you don't understand it in the same way that you do when you are actually observing it. So it's very common in a lot of programs, and I personally would speak in support of this requirement because it is such a standard in arts practice and really helps the students to understand things. And the way it was explained to the executive committee was that this was attendance at Queens College recital and events, unless I'm mistaken. But that's what we were told previously by the music department and by Ed, that this is Queens College only, where they swipe their cue card and the attendance is counted. And they don't pay to go to the recitals. I think the music students go for free. So.
Mark Hansen Cartwright from Music. So I can just confirm what my colleague from, is it drama or dance? Drama. that it's true that this is actually the kind of thing that a lot of schools do. It wasn't the case when I was an undergraduate in Toronto, but at another institution here in the New York City area, I taught at Hofstra, and they were imposing this kind of thing on students. One reason it even is happening, that we have to make it into a requirement, is that if you don't require it of students, they will tend not to go to their peers' performances. So what you have is a recital hall where students give recitals to a handful of people instead of a generous turnout. So this is one way to enhance the attendance at these recitals. The other thing is that it's obviously part of their education to hear performances as well as perform in them. So that would be, I think, the justification I would give. And I think it would be appropriate to clarify in this blue document that the recital attendance would be on campus. And that I think that would be an easy fix to the bulletin, because I think that's what's meant. It's how I understand it, and I think how the colleagues of mine in music would have interpreted it. It never occurred to me that it need clarifying, because the students know that. They know what we expect of them. It's just that until we hold a gun to their head, they will take the liberty not to go to these recitals. So.
One of your colleagues from the science division would like to speak strongly in favor of this also, and this body will be asked fairly soon to vote on a similar proposal in which we are requiring our graduate students to attend colloquia in the department, because we think that learning from speakers bringing information to us from places other than Queens College is important, keeps us abreast of what's going on, and I can certainly see where in music, listening to a colleague, a peer, playing, singing, whatever, is an important thing as part of their development also, which just broadens their education. So I would certainly not want this returned. I think we can vote on it right now. And the music school has been waiting a long time for us to vote on this. We should have voted on it two meetings ago, but unfortunately there was a mistake in understanding what had happened before. So this is long overdue. It's been polished, it's been repolished, it's been justified. I think we vote on it now.
I don't know if my colleague from the philosophy department would object if we voted on it, or do you wish for further revisions? Is this a friendly amendment?